Laura Smaliguzzi said, all people, and I mean scholars, researchers, and teachers, who in any place have set themselves to study children seriously, have ended up by discovering not so much the limits and weaknesses of children, but rather their surprising and extraordinary strengths and capabilities. My guest today has been on an incredible journey of practice and thought in early childhood education. She has a remarkable way of deconstructing constructivist education in her books and presentations. Today, she will support us in finding and building meaning with children and helping us become awakened to Reggio. Lisa Q has worked in many roles with both young children and adults as an instructional coach, classroom teacher, teacher educator, and researcher. She was the director of early education for the city of Somerville, Massachusetts, and worked with Head Start programs to create access to high-quality early education opportunities. Lisa has been part of the faculty at Tufts University, University of New Hampshire, and Lesley University, and is the author of the books Complementary Curriculum Approach, Transform Your Practice Through Intentional Teaching, as well as Thinking Critically About Environments for Young Children. Lisa has such an accessible way of helping people deepen their planning and build on children's theories and research. I'm so excited to have you join us. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you so much. I've been listening to your podcast and I'm such a big fan. And so thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm going to jump right in. What has been your journey with the Reggio approach?
I had this interesting teacher training experience as a college student where I went to Chestnut Hill College in Philadelphia, and they had a Montessori teacher preparation program there. And you could do that at the same time that you did your public school teacher preparation, preschool through third grade. So I had this interesting double major, and I was constantly going back and forth and back and forth between, you know, what we might term as a traditional public school environment and Montessori environment. So I did student teaching in both contexts, and it made my brain immediately be bilingual, trilingual to various approaches. So even though I worked in Montessori schools, I worked in non-Montessori schools over a period of time, I was always layering. I was always thinking like, how can I complement this? I was also really fortunate in my very first job at the Greentown School, which is a Montessori school in Philadelphia, still there, to have had people around me who were artists, musicians, and we used the Philadelphia neighborhood of our school as our classroom. The art museum, which was up the street, was our backdrop, and I didn't know it then, but we had an atelier in our building. We had a little art studio and an amazing teacher. And so we were constantly doing projects that were related to the city. I knew no other way than to do Montessori education in this way. And I had seen it in other non-Montessori environments as well. So that's a little bit to say, like, we were doing this thing. I didn't necessarily have a name for it until many years later. In the early 90s, I was working in Seattle, Washington in a preschool, and it was actually a pre-K through fifth grade school, very progressive, and we were very project oriented. And we wanted to have someone come and talk with us about creativity. And a lot of the teachers at this school had gone to Pacific Oaks, which then had a campus in Seattle. And John Nimmo was there, who many of you may be familiar with. And so they said, well, we should have John come and talk with us about creativity. And in the early 90s, you know, it was especially on the West Coast, like Reggio was new. It wasn't something today that, you know, many teachers know. They may not be doing it or practicing that approach, but they've heard of it and it's come into college courses, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was new to me. So he came in and showed us the amusement park for the birds with some video and led us through some beautiful exercises on creativity. And that's how I was first introduced to it. And it mapped on to some of the things that I had already been doing, and then also expanded my thinking in ways that I had never imagined could be. And at the same time, I was still, it had that Montessori piece, some of those prepared environment, access and choice for children to materials, slow, methodical presentation of that builds success into children's experiences over time. That was still very much a part of the work that I was doing in my own practice. So
in Reggio, they would say they're inspired also by Montessori. So, yeah. You know, while they're coming from really theoretically different places, there's so many beautiful weavings together of some of the big ideas. With the amusement park for birds, for our listeners, you can actually find that online on YouTube. You can find the video. It's pretty old and yet so amazing that I literally just shared it with somebody yesterday. So I love that you're bringing it up.
And then in 2006, I was back on the East Coast and I was doing a little bit of adjunct work at Wheelock College and met many of the folks who were connected to Making Learning Visible and Project Zero, and ended up going on a study tour shortly after arriving back in the Boston area. And so that was also a life-changing experience to be able to go see schools in action and in real time, be able to debrief with my colleagues about what we were seeing and how we might bring this work in new ways to the folks we were working with in schools.
You remember back to that study tour to Reggio and what struck you or surprised you?
I mean, aside from the environments and the beautiful curation of them, which I think is a visceral reaction that people have when they immediately walk into those schools, but another one was we talked with teachers a lot about professional development and about planning time. And what stood out to me as a teacher educator was how that stood in stark contrast to the lack of planning time and teacher reflection that teachers in the United States typically have. And even in my own work on how do teachers transfer professional development experiences into practice? You know, at the root of the literature around that is the literature around reflective practice. And when you ask teachers, when do you reflect on your practice? They say two things. They say in the shower, and they say on my way to school, whether it's on public transportation or whether they're driving. So they don't typically say, oh, well, you know, I have these few hours a week where, you know, I sit with my colleagues and we have yummy snacks and look at all the documentation of what our kids have been doing all week and then figure out what we're going to do next. Like no one ever.
It is a pretty rare thing. And yet we know that it is such an important piece of moving a school forward and moving teachers forward. I've heard you speak so beautifully about planning. I listened to a webinar that you had done and how you broke it down for people in a way that was really accessible. Could you give us an example of this way of planning that you speak about? And maybe what would you suggest as like a beginning point for teachers who are interested in thinking this way? I think it's always helpful to hear just maybe a little process that you've seen in a classroom.
I was thinking about this last week when I was talking with a teacher who said her teaching assistant came in and had some leaves and was gluing the leaves onto a piece of paper so they could make like Leaf Man related to the Leaf Man book. And so she had this project but there wasn't anything else connected to it necessarily, right? Okay. So, you know, props to the teacher for knowing that the children were interested in leaves and then, okay, I've got this activity that I found, you know, in this online. And then I said, oh, let's talk a little bit about, we started talking about leaves and the properties of leaves. And we got into a conversation about leaf rubbing and, you know, use the side of the crayon to bring up the beautiful veins and characteristics and attributes of a leaf. And she had never seen this before. And so we just ended up talking about it. And then her lead teacher came in and the assistant was showing the teacher and she said, oh, well, that's great, but maybe we can do it next week because this week is solar system. So,
ouch.
So it was a,
yeah,
it was a really, you know, just super clear example of a typical way that teachers in early childhood offer themes to children, right? And it's sort of, it's so fast, right? It's, I have a slide that I show sometimes that has a list of over 40 different themes that actually schools have done in a year. So it's like, okay, quick, on to the next thing. And they're not even linked, right? So 1 week is cars, and the next week is leaves, and the next week is ocean, and the next week is solar system, and the next week is community helpers. And it just goes so fast. And it's all linked to maybe four or five activities that children are going to do at centers to produce products related to that topic. So that's doesn't happen everywhere, but it happens a lot. It's seemed as being efficient and effective of getting as much content into kids as possible. So the theme can still be the entry point, but it really depends on what you do with it. And as we just spoke about, it really requires that reflection and inquiry on the part of adults and children. So when I go into a school or I'm working with teachers, I talk with them about their own curiosity about that topic. So as opposed to starting with the activity, like, oh, I found this really cute paper plate solar system. I want to make that with the kids. And then that becomes the focal point and the entry point. The entry point needs to be what you are curious about as an adult. And why are you curious about it? Because your children are curious about it? Or maybe you think it's something really important that's happening in your culture, in your context that you want children to know about. So this idea that themes can come from an adult, but they have to be connected to something that's relevant for the child. So systematically, I work with teachers to help them sit down and do some concept mapping. Make a list with your team of what are you curious about this topic, you personally. So what do we wonder? And what do we think the children will wonder? And from that brainstorming comes what we call the framing of a big idea. So, and a big idea is something that is, you know, broad enough to really be conceptual, but specific enough that you can really dive deep into an aspect of it that will be interesting for children. I often say, like, oh, well, if you wanted to say, what are you studying with your children? The big idea is this concept that you could say, and it's not, we're studying about cars. Let's say the topic was transportation. Instead, a big idea after I've done some brainstorming and maybe thought a little bit about how my kids get to school, there might be an interesting big idea of, you know, we're really studying about how people get from one place to another. So if I say that to you, Sandy, right? If I say, Sandy, this week we're going to study about cars. We're going to learn about cars. So your brain might go in one direction. But if I say, Sandy, from our brainstorming, let's work with the children on this big idea of people get from one place to another. How do people get from one place to another?
And it's so much, it's so about the emotion too, because if you say cars to me, although some people I know love, love, love cars,
right?
But really the idea of how do you get from here to there, thinking about what's on the other end of it and all of those pieces of it, that's when you get to real dialogue and all the things that the emotion will bring forward. So I love that you're making that distinction for people.
And then you know, then you take it to the children, right? When you said dialogue, so who else is the dialogue with? Oh, it's with your colleagues. You've done some reflecting. Then you take it to the children and you ask them, like, you know, I've noticed that some people have been talking a little bit about how they get to school. And I've been thinking a little bit about how people get from one place to the other. Tell me a little bit about what you know about how people get to school, or how do people, if you wanted to go somewhere, what are some ways you, right? So you start to bring in these conceptual conversations with children, and then that in turn continues to shape what you will do next and what direction you will go in. I'll give you a sweet example of that from a teacher I was working with in Somerville. We had a sort of a loose thematic curriculum that was a guide for folks throughout the year, and they could use some of those ideas in ways that didn't have to go in lockstep. But almost everyone, and actually, like if we think about anti-bias education, this is pretty typical. You know, you're going to do something that's related to children's identity and who they are and who the people in their community are. So this teacher was getting ready to move into a space of like, who is around us? Like, who are the people in our world? And so she was doing some work with the kids around who are the people in our school. And they were walking around and they were interviewing all kinds of people. And it was interesting and the kids were into it. And what they were really into was, how did this building get built? Who made this building? How long has this building been here? And so it was just this beautiful way of, you know, you might start somewhere and then giving yourself the freedom and the time to let it go into something else. And then the big idea became something about, you know, buildings are constructed in different ways and they started to frame it differently. And it was just a great example of that teacher inquiry and interest and then being responsive to children as well.
Yeah, I think that sometimes people get really stuck in the big idea that they've started with. And really, this approach is not linear at all. And there are going to be many branches of research that come off of that, that are relaunched from the original. I think my first attachment to you was through your book, The Complementary Curriculum Approach. Mm-hmm. I would love you to tell us about your book and how it came to be. And really, this idea of intentionality is very strong in the book. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that idea of intentionality and any other messages that you want to share with us.
So, you know, the book was really something that evolved over time and was a reflection of that complementary practice that I talked about before, that was I was fortunate to have as the foundation for learning to teach and the integration of different theories. A couple things happened. So talked about being surrounded by art as a new teacher in a Montessori environment. And so that sparked that curiosity and then layering that idea of improvisation as part of a teaching practice, but improvisation that has intention behind it. Later, when I was working in Boston, I was working at Tufts University in the lab school, and Debbie Lee Keenan, who's also a great friend and colleague of John Nimmo, and they've done some beautiful work on the anti-bias education approach and anti-bias leaders. So please check that out. It was an interesting job because I was teaching in the morning with children and then working with adult learners, graduate and undergraduate students in the afternoons, teaching coursework and then doing research. And I was doing my thing, you know, so I had, you know, just some very typical Montessorians would walk into the classroom and be like, yep, I see you. I see what you're doing here. There's some shelf work with trays and areas that are defined, you know, you can define as like a math area, a language area, a practical life area with materials for self-help and care of the community, care of the environment, and just a huge art area and blocks and dramatic play. Like, it was all there. And I had a colleague, Iris Ponte, who's my writing partner, and she was a postdoc student. And she came into my classroom and she was like, what's happening in here? Like, this is not something I have seen before. And she's really like an ethnographer, anthropologist at heart, and is always looking at what's happening cross-culturally and has done a lot of research in that area. And so she and I started to talk a lot about what was happening and this idea of people having to choose one way or another. Like, I'm play-based, I'm Reggio, I'm Montessori, I use creative curriculum, and never shall they shall they meet? And we could see how siloed our field was. Later, Iris opened her own little school and was kind of her own lab for working on some of these concepts. And we wrote an article for Exchange Magazine. I can't even remember what it was called. It was like blended, you know, approach or something, you know, it sounded like a butter substitute. And so we were just like, how are we going to conceptualize this idea of de-siloing? And so at the same time, what was happening was Iris and I were doing consulting, or I would go and do a workshop and she would be called to go and do a workshop. And we were hearing the same things all over. We were hearing teachers and directors in childcare centers coming to us and saying, we have this problem of practice. They didn't say problem of practice. That's, we were characterizing it as that, based on some of it was part of the narrative was, hey, I've been introduced to the Reggio approach and I love it. I think it's magical and fabulous and I really aspire to it. So what I did was I went and I bought beautiful baskets and I bought just the most, you know, and I found these pine cones in my yard and like I brought them in. So they're thinking very carefully about like materials and environment, and they bring them into their classrooms and they're expecting, like, I'm not sure what, but like magical things will come down from the sky and then children will suddenly look like the children they've seen in the videos or in talks they've seen or in the slides. And they're incredibly disappointed. And so what happens is the teachers feel a lack of confidence. The kids, they said, the kids just dumped everything all over the place and I had to put everything away. So the children get blamed for not being able to use materials in specific ways, in the ways that teachers had intended. And teachers feel like, oh, the kids are wrecking my environment and I spent a lot of time working on this. And it was just exactly the wrong dynamic that we would want to see between children and teachers and supporting. So it got us thinking about intention behind your aspiration for what you want to see in your classroom. So we actually started talking with teachers about their beliefs about education. And we would do things we still do, like give people quotes and have them talk about how it relates to their practice, or statements about early childhood, or talk about their beliefs. And then we would ask them, like, how does this look in your classroom? And what we found was that there was a huge gap there. People will say they believe one thing, but then in practice, they're actually doing another. And this is the same all over. So I've gone into environments where I would say, you know, the classrooms were not necessarily safe for children. Teachers were really unhappy. But when you ask those teachers about their beliefs and about children, they all say wonderful things. In most cases, sometimes not, but most of them will say things like, you know, I really want children to, you know, develop confidence. I want them to learn, and I want them to be, you know, if they're feeling like, I want them to be ready and great learners when they go to their next school. But the how do you have that put into action has not been taught. And it actually must be intentionally taught, because adults are learners too. And yet we often feel like, let me just show them some beautiful things and then they'll know how to do it. The same is true for Montessori training. The same is true if you're using creative curriculum. The same is true if you're, it doesn't matter what you're doing. There has to be some intentional learning experiences behind what teachers should know and be able to do. And they need mentorship and internship in order to do it. It's not that, you know, someone gets a 6-week crash course in Reggio and then is automatically leading a classroom and a team of teachers. They're working collaboratively, sometimes for years before someone takes on a leadership role in their approach. So that was sort of how the book came to be. So we wrote an article. We were doing workshops at NAEYC nationally. And what we were saying was resonating with people. A lot of like, oh my gosh, where have you been all my life? Can you come and help me to bring some intention into my work?
Well, I think it really does address the gap that you were talking about between what people believe and what their practice looks like.
We ended up with a series of questions, and I'll tell you the questions. And the questions sort of led to what we call the four intentions in the book. So people would come to us with their problems, and we'd be like, and I'm going to try and say this like with as much love and respect as possible, but it was, tell me more about the way you designed the materials for children. Like, and then like in my other brain, I'm like, was it interesting to them at all? Like, was it, I wouldn't say that necessarily to a teacher, but like in my brain, I'm like, wow, was it interesting to the child? Like, tell me more about how you designed and chose to put that work out, that toy out, those materials out, offer that play experience. And then the next question we would often ask was, and sometimes very directly, was, did you show the children how to handle, use that material? So the first intention became designing compelling materials. The second one was explicit presentation. And people get super afraid of this second one because they think it's going to stunt children's growth and creativity. But actually, children need to know how to handle things. They need to know how to carry things from getting from one place in the room to another. They need to know how to take things out of baskets with care and love and return them and get them ready for the next friend so the work is ready for them. And sometimes they need some presentation on process. Like, here's actually how you squeeze out a sponge so you can wash that pumpkin or that, you know, baby or whatever you're doing. So it doesn't have to be, here's how you will do this and you will not vary from it. But those explicit presentations help children to develop independence and confidence with process. So those were two. The third one was, how did you support the child once they were engaged in the activity? So that's the third intention, which is responsive scaffolding. Are you scaffolding, and this comes right from Vygotsky's work, are you scaffolding children's learning, offering them a place of independent performance, supporting their movement through the zone of proximal development to a new level of independent performance where you are not the focal point, the teacher is not the focal point? And how do you move in and move out, which is a dance that teachers need to learn how to do, be coached how to do, be taught how to do. And then the last intention was this interesting to the children? Is the thing that you're doing interesting? So following children's interests became the fourth intention. And following children's interest actually has two tracks. One is, are you setting up the environment so kids can actually choose things on their own? Or are they waiting for you to serve them like they're in a restaurant? Which is often what happens in classrooms, and the teachers are sweating because the restaurant is so busy and the customers are so demanding and they don't tip well. And, you know, it's just a terrible thing. So are you offering children a chance and teaching them how to make choices throughout their day and make decisions about what they want to do because it's things they're interested in? And then, as we started out talking about with big ideas, are you using big ideas that are relevant to children's lives as a way to follow children's interests? So those became our four intentions: compelling materials, explicit presentation, responsive scaffolding, and following children's interest. And in a way, it was like everybody needs these intentions. It doesn't matter what silo you've put yourself in, or if you are not siloing yourself and want to look at a range of approaches, that everyone from Reggio-inspired teachers to Montessori teachers to a teacher in a Head Start program using High Scope or Creative Curriculum needs to be thinking about these intentions in order to create a successful learning environment.
Yeah, it really sounds like every single chapter that you're talking about is really all about the role and the dispositions of the teacher in how we are and how we bring all of this to children. I'm hoping that people check it out because I really think it just will connect with you for sure and your teaching. So Lisa, I'm really interested in the word learning or the image of learning. I think that there are many incorrect assumptions made about teaching because there's so much confusion about what real learning is. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about how we prepare the environment for true learning, and how do we know when we've gotten there?
Ooh, I'm going to give you an example, a little story from when I first started in Somerville Public Schools. The assistant superintendent, who was a longtime educator, but was mostly a high school science person at his heart. And he said, you know, what I really want to do, we were tasked with building a mixed delivery system that would bring public schools, center-based programs, and Head Start under sort of one consortium to think about how we would bring quality education into our city. And he said, but I have a lot to learn about early childhood. I'm not an early childhood educator. And I'm wondering if we could do some learning walks together and just walk through like pre-K and K classrooms in the district. So we met at one of the schools and there were two classrooms side by side. We walked into one, and in one classroom, it was very quiet. And all the children were sitting at their own spots at different tables. And they were all working. This was like right when they came in the morning. Okay. So it's like, you know, 8:30. This is their arrival routine. So they came in, they had their designated spots. It was very quiet. Every child was on task with a, you know, writing implement in their hand. They had a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper in front of them, and everybody was working, and the teacher was kind of walking around. And, you know, so we hung out there for a little bit and didn't, I was like, I'm not going to say anything. We're just going to debrief later. Okay. Then we go next door. And each of these classrooms has about 24 children. We go next door. Noise level considerably higher. There are what seem to be, like to the untrained eye, different areas in the room where children are congregating. And within each of these areas, they're working on some kind of task in a small group. So one area on the rug, they're doing some kind of patterning work with bottle caps. There was another one where a group of kids were standing around an easel, puzzling over a morning message. Then there was another one where they were at a table doing something. So we're like 5 or 6 different areas. I'm of course like listening to the conversations that are happening among the children, which is great. So we walk out in the hallway and he says, well, the first classroom, they were certainly more engaged. I had a flashback in that moment to my advisor in my doctoral program, Bill McDermott, who was he was at University of Washington and then went on to be the dean at College of Ed and in University of North Carolina. And Bill said, does engagement equal learning? Like, does it? Like, and what is engagement anyway? And that has been, that was, you know, back, you know, way before, it was like probably like, you know, 10, 15 years before this incident of walking into these two classrooms. And I just had this flash of like, oh my gosh, like we have to really puzzle out and trouble up this idea of like, what is engagement? Does it equal learning? What do authentic learning experiences look like? And what are they comprised of? And so Vince and I had in the hallway right then and there had this big conversation, and I had to school him a little bit on why classroom number one, you have no idea what kind of learning, like learning is not visible in that room. We don't know what kind of experience they're having with the worksheet. And just because it's quiet and everyone is still, like, are those the components of an authentic learning experience? Because the children weren't moving around and it didn't feel like it was, you know, as quote unquote chaotic. And I really have an issue with that word. A lot of times people will use the word chaotic to describe an environment that they think is great and full of learning. Yeah. And I would argue that the second classroom was not chaotic at all. It was actually very well choreographed and designed for children to interact with each other, to have internalized routines that supported concept development in certain areas, and was a full and rich learning experience in which a teacher could easily see and document children's learning. And so it was just a really fabulous example of that, that made me do some learning and clarification. So when you think about like your question about how do we prepare an environment for real learning experiences, then we start to think about freedom within structure and choice. and shared control with children, where the adult is not the epicenter of everything that happens in that room, and that there's flexibility within the environment, and that the prepared environment itself, the physical environment, is set up to support those interactions and that success. And for me, that's inherently an equity issue. So if I think about what happens with kids at center times, and we think about authentic learning, we have some serious equity issues at hand, because you might set up 5 centers in your room and expect children to move through those centers in a timed way. And some kids want to be there for 20 minutes and others want to be there for 30 seconds. And so the behavioral issues that result from some of the ways in which we are preparing environments for children and designing learning experiences mean that we are going to be targeting some children and actually promoting behavioral issues that children get blamed for. And a lot of times it's our boys of color and boys in general. So we need to be thinking more carefully about what children need in terms of movement, in terms of choice, in terms of interaction.
I feel like you offered us so many ideas that kind of challenge some of the ways that people have thought about education for a long time. And a thread that I see throughout all of it is this idea of intentionality. I hear in every word that you're saying that there's thought that needs to happen beforehand. And I think that's just such a wonderful, powerful message for all of us. If you are looking for entry points, please check out Lisa's book. I think you will find some things that will be really helpful for you. Thank you so much, Lisa. I'm so excited to know you and to hear the beautiful thoughts that you have for all of us about children and teachers and being together. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. And I will say, Iris and I are working on a terrific website, complementarycurriculumapproach.com. So check that out too. And we'll have some modules up there soon, and you can do some learning on your own and with us. So Sandy, it's just this, thank you for your thoughtful and inspiring questions. I really, really appreciated getting to talk to you today.
If you would like to learn more about my guests or the Reggio approach, please go to my website at sandylanesconsulting.com.